So we've been talking about the two principal ways to generate bodhicitta, the enlightened aspiration. One was the seven-point instruction of cause and effect, and the second one was equalizing and exchanging self and others. And so we're doing this second one now. And last time we talked about in the second way of equalizing, exchanging self and others, we began by first the equanimity meditation, as with the other technique. Then we equalize self and others, seeing that everybody wants happiness, nobody wants suffering, and we're all totally equal in that respect. So there's no reason to favor ourselves and forget about others. And we thought about the disadvantages of the self-centered attitude that's always thinking, me, 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 I want, I need, I have to have, I must, I. And the benefits of cherishing others. That's what we did last time. I just returned from His Holiness the Dalai Lama's teachings in New York, and one of the texts that he was teaching was the seven-point thought transformation. And in the second point of that text, two of the lines are banish the object of all blame into one, you know. And the second line was remember the great kindness of all. So banishing the object of all blame into one is to see that all of our suffering and unhappiness comes from the self-centered thought. And then remembering the great kindness of all is to open our hearts and be aware that we've been the recipient of a tremendous amount of kindness from friends, strangers, people we don't like, everybody. And the first day His Holiness covered that thought, those two lines, he just said, well, that sums up the whole thought training teaching, so we'll end here, because it was at the end of the day. The next day, he came back to those two lines, and he started explaining them. And as he did so, he started to cry. And the whole auditorium was hushed, because His Holiness was, you know, feeling so much how true those two lines were. So it's quite remarkable when you see your teacher cry, you know, especially somebody like His Holiness. And it really, I think, emphasizes to us the importance of those two things. Yeah, remembering that the self-centeredness is the cause of all of our own and others' suffering. And remembering the great kindness of all beings and therefore cherishing them, wanting to work for their benefit. Okay, so the step after that is where we actually exchange self and others. So at this point, you know, we're so convinced, theoretically, that self-centeredness is the cause of all suffering. And I say theoretically because we might say that all up here, but we don't really live as if our self-preoccupation is the cause of suffering, do we? When you look at your life, do you live? Do you make decisions and choose what to do based on the thought that self-centeredness is the cause of suffering? No, we don't. I mean, let's be honest about it, okay? Yeah. And do we base decisions on, you know, the thought that's really cherishing others? And remember, cherishing others is different than feeling guilty about being selfish and taking care of others because we feel obliged or because we want to get brownie points or win their favor or make them feel indebted to us or something like that. It's different. Those things are different. Okay, so of course, you know, the intellectual understanding comes first, and it's only by repeated introspection and meditation that we bring the understanding from here into our heart. And I think it's important that we're very honest about where we are, because if we're not, and if we get what I call Mickey Mouse Bodhisattva, you know, like, oh yes, I cherish all beings more than myself and I really care about them. And if we really think we're doing that, what happens is we get manipulative. And then we start getting angry at all those uncooperative sentient beings who don't realize how we're working for their benefit. Okay, so I think it's good to, you know, we're just honest about where we're at, and through that honesty, then we can start to transform the way our mind functions. Okay, so based on, you know, some sort of understanding the disadvantages of self-centeredness and the benefits of cherishing others, we then do the practice called exchanging self and others. Now, exchanging self and others doesn't mean I become you and you become me, okay? And it doesn't mean that my bank account becomes yours and your bank account becomes mine, you know, and that your house becomes mine and my house becomes yours, because then you're going to be on the street. But, okay? But, so exchanging self and others doesn't mean that, you know, we take each other's stuff. What it means is that previously the one we cherished the most was this one, me. So we're exchanging that, and now the one we cherish most is going to be others. Okay? And previously we used to look at others and go, yeah, they're okay, but they're next best. First is me. Now, when we exchange self and others, we look at our own happiness and we say, well, yeah, that's nice, but it's second best. First is others. Okay, so we're exchanging, you know, who it is that we focus on and care the most about. Okay, so this doesn't mean that we negate ourselves. It doesn't mean that we become martyrs. Yeah, because all of those things, you know, if we negate ourselves and don't take care of ourselves, then we become a big burden for other people. Yeah, that's not very compassionate. And if we become martyrs, there's tons of ego involved in martyrdom. Yeah. You know, giving one's life with a real altruistic intention is very different than becoming a martyr. Okay, especially with the present connotation of martyrdom. So, it simply means that we're opening the scope of who we consider important and really cherishing others. This holiness has us do this very nice little exercise, because the ego is very resistant to this thing of exchanging self and others. You know, it's like, what do you mean care about others the way I care about myself? No way! Yeah, but he said, especially for those of us from democratic countries who believe in, you know, majority rule, if you think how many of there are of me, there's one person who's me, how many others? Countless. So if we're going to have a vote over whose happiness is more important, one person, me, or countless minus one, others, who is the democratically elected recipient of who we cherish the most? Okay? It's very clear. Now we don't believe in democracy anymore. No joking, but, you know, and if you look at it that way, it really makes some sense, you know. I mean, I'm only one person, and there's, you know, all these countless other beings out there, so I... No, it actually does make more sense to really cherish them and be aware of their happiness and suffering. Okay? So, of course, our mind puts up a big battle to doing this. We don't like that, and we come up with all sorts of doubts about the practice. So Shantideva, in Chapter 8 of Guide to Bodhisattva's Way, he teaches this practice, and he voices in the verses that he writes the various doubts that our self-centered mind makes up about why it's impossible to exchange self and others. So I just wanted to abbreviate these a little bit for you. Okay. Okay, so one doubt, okay, and just imagine, you know, take your self-centered mind and imagine it as an external person, you know, give it a face. Yeah, I mean, you can even think of it, you know, whatever form you like, then, you know, a person, a monster, a blob, whatever it is, okay, but imagine that our self-centered mind is saying, others' suffering doesn't affect me, so why should I work to dispel it? Sounds good, doesn't it? I mean, other people's suffering doesn't affect me. Why should I care? Yeah, they should pick themselves up by their own bootstraps. I read Ayn Rand, and I firmly believe that, you know? You just work for yourself, and, you know, that way the world turns out better. So what, you know, why should we work to dispel others' suffering? Well, one reason is that we're interrelated, and that others' suffering affects us. And I think this is why His Holiness says, if you want to be selfish, be wisely selfish and care for others. Okay? Because if we only work for ourselves and forget about others, we're going to be living in a society with a lot of other unhappy people. And what do people do when they're unhappy? Yeah? They crash jetliners into the World Trade Center. Now, they break into our homes. They do, you know, whatever it is. They write graffiti on the walls. Yeah. So, I remember years ago living in Seattle, and there was a bill up for property taxes that would go to the school, for schools. And, you know, people without children didn't want to pay more property tax to have more schools and increase the after-school recreational activities and educational things, you know. And these people were just thinking, well, me, you know, and my money, and the people who have kids, they should pay for this. But when kids don't have education and when they don't have recreational activities, what do? They get into mischief. Whose houses are they going to break into? The people whose houses didn't vote for the bond that would give more money to the schools. Okay? So it becomes totally self-defeating when we only work for ourselves. You know? And why we want to put more money into building prisons, but we don't want to put money into prevention. No, we have to think about this as a society, if our approach is correct to really creating happiness for ourselves and others. Okay, so our interdependence is one reason why we should take care of others, and why, you know, we should work to dispel others' suffering. Another reason is that the difference between self and others is something that exists by being merely labeled. Okay, remember we did this thing before, that on the basis of these aggregates, this body and mind here on this cushion, we say I, or I say I, and on the basis of that body and mind on another cushion, I say other. Yeah. But of course, from your perspective, you know, each person in this room thinks of their own aggregates and says I, and looks to me and everybody else and says other. So who's the inherently existent I, and who's the inherently existent other? There isn't any, okay, because it depends completely on what you happen to be labeling. So it's like the example of this side of the mountain and that side of the mountain, this side of the valley, the other side of the valley. Depends upon where you are. So we have just become very familiar with labeling I in dependence on these aggregates. Yeah. But we could become equally as familiar by labeling I on the basis of other people's aggregates. Okay. So when we see somebody else experiencing physical or mental suffering, to start to think, I'm unhappy, or I'm in pain. You know, because from that person's viewpoint who's experiencing that, they are saying, I'm unhappy or I'm in pain. Okay? So if we familiarize ourselves with a new way of labeling and get very familiar with it, we can actually train our mind to care as much about others as we now care about ourselves. Okay? And you see this for, you know, those of you who have kids now, that when your child is unhappy, you know, when your child is sick, you know, you wish you could exchange their suffering with your happiness. You know, it just kind of comes. Yeah. So it's because you're labeling I on the other aggregates and cherishing them, you know, the aggregates of the child. Okay, so it's possible to so closely identify with others in this way that we can really cherish them without having some kind of ulterior motivation. Yeah, without painting on something or, you know, having mental gymnastics or doing manipulation, but genuinely, honestly cherishing others. Okay, so, you know, back to the question of why should I dispel their suffering, it doesn't harm me. Well, it's only because we cherish this body that we can't bear to see it harmed. And that cherishing that we have for our own body is, you know, exists under the influence of ignorance, the grasping at an inherently existent I and an inherently existent body. And so that kind of grasping is the source of cyclic existence. So when we fall prey to it and are so attached to our body in that way, we're just creating more and more suffering for ourselves because we're acting out of that misconception that thinks there's a real I, real and a real solid body. Okay? So you know, when we look like that, we see that yes, it does make sense to care about others' suffering, even though it doesn't directly affect us. When still, okay, then in Shantideva's little dialogue, still the mind makes up another thing. It's more, you know, because it's petulant. You know, our ego is this petulant thing. It says, but others' suffering doesn't harm me. You know, why should I care about them? And we've probably said this. I mean, if you watch a bunch of three-year-olds, it kind of comes out of their mouth. We're more sophisticated. We pretend we don't think like this. okay. Well, if that's true, that others' suffering doesn't harm me, then why do we work for the happiness of the old person that we're going to become? Because the old person that we're going to become isn't us. Okay? You getting what I mean? We're just saying, you know, I want to be happy. Why should I care about anything else other than me? Well, the old person that we're going to become isn't the me who we are right now. It's somebody else. Yeah. Isn't it? Is it you or is it somebody else? Yeah? Are you feeling the suffering that you would feel when you're 80 years old right now?
No, but it's still going to be me.
Well, you don't even know that you're going to live that long. You know, so you don't even know that 80-year-old is going to come into being. You don't even know if the you at 80 years old is going to exist. But you work very hard for his happiness, don't you? You save money. Yeah, you plan your retirement. You make sure you have health insurance. Yeah, that person that you know, is 60 or 80 or however you want to be, may not ever actually exist. But we cherish him or her very much and work very hard for his or her happiness. But, you know, maybe they don't even exist. But that makes sense to us, doesn't it? To work so hard for that person in the future who may never even exist. So that person in the future, that's not us. That's not us. I mean, if you got up and looked in the mirror and saw yourself and saw this 80-year-old person, would you say that's me? No way. You'd say, that's not me. Wouldn't you? If you got, if you went and looked in the mirror, there's a mirror right now. We all stood up and looked in the mirror. And you had this old wrinkled face with, you know, white hair, or absence of hair, and, you know, droop over body or whatever. Would you say that's me? No.
Who else would it be?
You're not 80 yet, Eric. You still have a ways to go. How old are you, Henry?
Wait, I gotta get it right. This time, 68.
68. Okay, you have a ways to go then too. So, you know, we if we saw that 80-year-old person, we wouldn't say that's me. That's somebody else. And yet we cherish that person. We work very hard for his or her welfare. But that's not us. Okay. Similarly, yeah, when our foot steps on a thorn, yeah, the hand reaches down and picks the thorn out of the foot instinctively, doesn't it? The hand doesn't go through this thing of, you know, I'm a hand and that's a foot. And why should I help the foot? You know, stupid foot, why didn't you look at where you were walking? Yeah. Yeah, the hand doesn't go through, you know, all this blaming and guilt trip and, you know, dumb foot, you know, again you stepped on something and I have to bandage you up. Look at how kind I am to you, taking care of you, stupid, incapable foot, yet again. You know, so you better remember how kind I, the great and glorious hand, am. You know, the hand doesn't go through that kind of trip. Hand just pulls the thorn out. But they're other, aren't they? The foot and the hand are other. They aren't the same thing. And yet one helps the other. Okay. Why? Because we conceive of them as being part of the same organism. Our mind puts the hand and the foot together and makes it part of the same organism. Now, in the same way, if we stopped focusing so much on the individual I and thought more of the collective, you know, that we are one group of sentient life, then helping another part of that identity becomes like helping ourselves in the same way that that the hand helps the foot and doesn't think twice about it. Okay. And now if the mind goes, but it's still my body and I gotta take care of my body. Yeah. Well, what's mine about the body? Okay. If you cut it open, do you find a big me? Yeah. If you laid out all your organs, you know, a couple of kidneys and an intestine, and a big and small intestine, the eyeballs and the spleen, you know, you laid them all out, would you look at that and say, that's mine, that's me? You'd say, yuck, wouldn't you? Okay, so what's mine about this body? And if we look at it, you know, that genetically, half of the genes came from our mother, half of the genes came from our father. So it's actually our parents' body, isn't it? It's not our body. What are we doing labeling I or mine on this body? We should be labeling mom and dad's body. Because it came from them, didn't it? The genes are theirs. Or maybe we should label it the farmer's body because all the broccoli and tofu and everything else we ate came from the farmers. Yeah, if you eat meat, you should call it the cow's body because your body is a transformation of the cow's body, isn't it? Or the chicken's body or the fish body. So how can we label it my body? There's nothing my about this thing. Yeah, it all came from other people. And yet we see by the power of just familiarization and the power of self-grasping, our idea of this being my body becomes so strong, it becomes, you know, so harder than a diamond, doesn't it? And yet that's just something completely invented by our mind, because there's nothing mind about this body. Now, body actually belongs to others. Yeah. If you go, but it's still mine, you know, well, you know, really, it's not. There's nothing about it that's ours. It's like thinking that money belongs to me. Yeah. Were you born with any money? Did you come out of your mother's womb with a fistful? No, we didn't. You know, we came out of our mother's womb totally broke. Any money we have now, we have because other people gave us, don't we? So the money actually belongs to other people. It's not my money. Everything we have, you know, your clothes, your house, your car, yeah, anything you have because somebody else gave it to you. You didn't come out of the womb with all these things. Okay? So in the same way, yet, you know, with all these things, we label them mine. Well, the same way our body, we only have it because other people gave it to us. The farmers gave us, you know, the food to eat. Mom gave half the genes, Dad gave half of the genes. So why are we making such a big deal about this is mine and making it so solid and holding on to it as an identity? Doesn't make much sense. Okay? So when you think about this, yeah, you can get this feeling that it becomes a little bit easier to maybe exchange self with others, because there's no real me here to start with. So this is why this technique of equalizing and exchanging self for others or with others is said to be for the bodhisattva, for somebody of higher faculties, okay? Whereas the seven-point instruction of cause and effect is for somebody of more modest faculties. Because you can see that exchanging self and others is getting us into a whole understanding about emptiness, isn't it? Okay. And how the body, the mind, and the I and the mind are all empty. So that's why it's for those of higher faculties. Okay. So what we come to when we dispel this difference between I and others, okay, by realizing that they aren't inherently existent, we come to see then that suffering is suffering no matter whose it is, and it's something to be dispelled no matter whose it is, and happiness is happiness no matter whose it is, and it's something to be worked for. And so on the basis of that, then changing who we care about the most, okay, I and others, becomes much easier to do that. Okay, now the mind keeps on making up more excuses why we can't exchange self and others. And it says, look, it's just too much of a burden to cherish others like I cherish myself. Yeah, why should I take on more suffering than I already have? Makes sense, doesn't it? You know, I mean, I'm already overwhelmed by suffering. Don't give me more. Yeah. Well, why? Why should we do it? Because caring only about our own suffering creates the cause of more suffering. And generating compassion and caring about others creates the cause of happiness. So actually, when we care about others' suffering, we're creating the cause for happiness, not the cause of suffering. Now somebody's going to say, but, you know, when, you know, my child or my dog or, you know, my friend is sick, and I see them suffering, or if somebody, you know, I watch TV and I look what's happening in Afghanistan and I see somebody suffering, that causes me pain. So why should I care about others' suffering? You know, that caring about it, just seeing it causes me pain. So why shouldn't I just block it out? You know, not care, not look at others' suffering, not care about others' suffering, because it just creates more pain in my own heart. Okay, the answer to this is that at this point, I think we've misunderstood a little bit about compassion. And we've gone from compassion into a sense of personal distress. And I remember being at one of the conferences of His Holiness with the Western scientists, and one of the psychologists was explaining about this. You know, because compassion is focused on the other, okay? Personal distress is focused on ourself. So if I see you suffering and I get unhappy because I can't bear to see you suffering, what's my mind focused more on, you or me? Me, okay? So we've fallen into personal distress at that point. If we stay focused on the other, yeah, okay, it means that we can still have empathy, yeah, but we don't let ourselves get bummed out by the suffering of the world. Why? Because we see that suffering only exists because the cause of suffering exists, and that isn't a given, you know, that suffering can be eliminated. So a bodhisattva always, even when they see others suffering, which is, you know, can be distressing to see, doesn't go into personal distress because they know that the suffering can be stopped. It may not be able to be stopped today or tomorrow or even this lifetime, but a bodhisattva knows that suffering isn't pre-programmed and a done deal that's going to exist forever. Okay, so when we look in these kinds of ways, you know, and it's good to let these doubts surface in our mind, and I think that was really Shantideva's skill when he wrote that section of the book, you know, letting all the doubts surface in our mind about why should I care about others, and how can I exchange myself and others, and what kind of stupid, ridiculous thing is this? You know, let those doubts surface, and then use our analytical wisdom to investigate the doubts and see if they, you know, have some kind of reasoning behind them, or if they're basically just, you know, self-centered, you know, what's the word, constructions or connivings of our own mind that doesn't want to really, you know, open up. Okay? So this meditation on exchanging self and others is very nice, and it can bring up a lot of stuff. But like I say, that's good because then we really can look very, very deeply and understand how our mind works and bring to the surface a lot of preconceptions that we haven't even recognized that we've had. Okay, and that's good when we do that because then we start investigating them. Okay, so the next step in the meditation is, after we've exchanged self with others, is to meditate on taking and giving. Mm-hmm.